Extonmos Experiment. Adventures in Wine and Space with Simon Exton and Ken Moss. Hello everyone, and a very warm welcome to our spooky Halloween edition of the Extonmos Experiment.
Ooh.
Ooh, indeed. I'm Ken Moss.
I'm Simon Exton.
And this year, we are watching the Trollenberg Terror.
It strikes without warning, wreaking death and destruction too horrible to behold. A force of evil that tortures its victims and hurls them mercilessly to the brink of murder and madness. What is it? And what does it crave, this creeping horror that hungers and thrives on human flesh, while it inhabits its own silent world that no man can penetrate? No one is safe from its spell of destruction, a cold hypnotic stare striking fear into the hearts of all, creating a frenzied nightmare for those who behold it.
There are four of them now, and all moving this way.
But before we do, it's time for a drink. It's time to get out the tonic screwdriver and get the lid off the gin bottle. This time we are drinking Batch Distillery Black Cat Gin. It's 40%, it's cherry and berry gin.
And hello, Ryan.
Hello, Ryan, at the head distiller at Batch. And the infobollock says, Black Cat Gin is a collaboration with Moorhouse's Brewery, taking inspiration from the Junga hop used in their limited edition Black Cat Reserve. We have created this spooky edition gin with blackcurrant, blackberry and cherry to mirror the fruity notes found in this hop. This spellbound potion will get your taste buds tingling.
And once again, I have to make note of the artwork on the label.
By Molly Jones.
Absolutely beautiful.
It is, actually. It's a very Halloween-y label. Yeah, brilliant. Well, first things first, it's pink.
It looks like Cherryade.
It does look like Cherryade. In fact, with the tonic in, it's fizzing.
Like Cherryade.
Like Cherryade. Now, we need to take a swig neat first.
And because we are nothing but classy, we're swigging from the bottle.
Straight from bottle, lad. For the purposes of the podcast, we are sat under a bridge with a burning oil drum next to us.
It smells medicinal. It tastes medicinal.
It tastes
like cough mixture.
I can see where you're coming from, although I'm getting that neat sort of cherry cordial sort of thing off it, so...
And it's quite tingly.
It is quite tingly. Oh, well, splashy splashy with the tonic and ice. Let's see what this is like. I'm getting nothing out of... How are we getting nothing out of the glass?
Well, Batch rarely has a smell to it.
It's true, but it looks so... Anyway.
It tastes medicinal. I'm not really getting berries from that at all, which I'm quite pleased about because... I don't like cherry. I like blackberry and I like blackcurrant, but I don't like cherry, so I wasn't looking forward to that bit of it. It doesn't taste berry-ish.
I think the cherry and berry temper each other, because I don't like cherry gins. I think they taste horribly artificial.
Sorry, I think this tastes artificial. I think this tastes like cough mixture. It's got a bit of a bitter aftertaste. I'm not wild keen on this.
I can see where you're coming from, but of all the cherry and berry gins that I've had, this is the best one I've had. At least I actually do like this one.
Absolutely. Mm. Of all the cherry gins that we've had, this is front and centre the best.
Yes.
Because it's the one that tastes least like cherry, and I don't like the taste of cherry.
Because we've had all those green alls, for example, that they've done a blueberry gin, and they're just a little bit, well, they're not a little bit, they're all artificial. There's a J.J. Whitley, they do a cherry one. I don't particularly care for that. It's all pink cherry. This is nothing like any of those. I can taste the cherry.
And there's a Bombay Bramble as well, isn't there, that's really not good. Of any of the cherry gins that we've had, this is the nicest, but I think it's kind of an artificial type flavour. I'm not wild keen myself. It's a 2 from me.
Oh, it's not that low. It's a 3 from me. Largely, again, because it's just not the sort of flavours that I gravitate towards. There is a bit of aftertaste. It does linger. But I think the berry is in there, but it tempers the cherry rather than being centre stage. It's an odd one to review, actually. But cherry, that would immediately, to be quite honest, put me off usually. That isn't as bad as, oh God, that sounds awful. It's not as bad as I feared, but cherry is just something I would have gone straight towards when I was a kid. It's something I run away from as an adult because, yeah, artificial. So fire up your broomstick. We shall fly down to the undergallery and open up the Black Archive. What are you rescuing?
I'm going to rescue a 1965 BBC drama series called Legend of Death. 525 minutes, and it was a modern-day reworking of the story of Theseus and the Minotaur in the labyrinth on the island of Crete.
Okay.
I mean, it has a tenuous connection to the Trollenberg Terror in that in the TV version of the Trollenberg Terror, Anne Pilgrim was played by Sarah Lawson, and Sarah Lawson is one of the leads in Legend of Death. All five episodes are missing. I just think it sounds fun.
Well, I'm quite keen on the old Minotaur myth, so yes, a little bit of an oddity. Well, I've got an oddity for you as well, really. It's David Frost's Moon Party. Yeah, the ITV coverage of the moon landing in 1969 was watched by more people than BBC's coverage, and it at the time was ITV's longest ever programme. It ran from 6 p.m. till 9 a.m. the morning after. But in between news and comments on the moon mission itself, it was alternated with David Frost's Gala Moon Party variety show. That featured personalities like Peter Cook, Cilla Black, Cliff Richard, Lulu, Mary Hopkin, Sammy Davis Jr., Engelbert Humperdinck.
Of Eurovision fame.
Yes, Hassie Jakes, Eric Sykes. Author Ray Bradbury objected to what he saw as the frivolous tone of the show and walked out before he could be interviewed. I'm sure there were podcasters out there that might mention Ray Bradbury.
Peggy Mount Boys, are you listening?
It's on the top 100 lost TV shows at the BFI. It sounds so utterly bonkers that I thought, well, what the hell, let's have it back for Halloween.
David Frost's variety stuff was invariably entertaining. His interviews are generally very good, but can be patchy.
Yes, we have views on this in a forthcoming episode.
It's a Brexit episode, so unsurprisingly, our views don't entirely tally.
Anyway, it's on with the motley. It's the Trollenberg Terror. Now, why have you picked this for Halloween?
Well, a couple of reasons. It's spooky. Trollenberg Terror was a ITV science fiction six-part serial from 1956. It was the first science fiction serial that ITV produced, and it's something that as a child or as a teenager when I was first getting into archive television, and obviously I was asking my folks what they remembered in terms of TV science fiction from when they were younger. My dad's attitude was basically, I don't watch any of that crap. And my mum had some recollections, and one of the strongest recollections she had was watching Trollenberg Terror and the Quatermass Experiment, because they'd be within a few years of each other. And my grandparents didn't have very much money, so she used to go round to her aunties to watch it, because they do that kind of thing in Preston.
Yes, we do that, yes.
It's all a bit inbred.
Born and inbred.
No, she had a very extensive, extended family growing up in Preston who, recognising how little money my grandparents had, helped with child support. And my great-aunt had a telly, so Mum went round and watched things like the Quatermass Experiment. She watched things like the Trollenberg Terror. And she was absolutely blown away by the Trollenberg Terror. She said how absolutely compelling it was, episode by episode by episode, with a very disappointing finale.
Mm.
And she particularly describes a very tense scene on a cable car where a couple of the main characters are trying to escape up the mountain. That doesn't really come across in the film. The scene's there, but it's not particularly tense. She massively preferred it to the Quatermass Experiment. Bear in mind, she'd have been a young teenager at the time, or actually pre-teenage. Mm. So something like this, which is drama and spectacle, might be preferable to a young one rather than the more conceptual and intellectual horror of the Quatermass Experiment.
Mm. Yes, because it's arguably more visual, the Quatermass Experiment, even in film form.
Well, especially in film form, yeah. Because I suspect a lot of those special effects weren't as well realised on live-produced telly.
Probably not, particularly since Nigel Neal actually cobbled them together himself because they couldn't afford any special effects.
Yeah. But this was an ITV production, not a BBC production.
Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, I've never seen this before, so I'm quite looking for the title in itself is intriguing enough, The Trollenberg Terror.
It's all very 1950s B-movie, terribly dramatic. And it is a 1950s very dramatic B-movie and a really entertaining one.
Well, let's find out what it's like. Like the Pumpkins, put on your cloaks. Let's watch it. Run, VT.
Alan, what is all this about?
There was an old woman down there. She was clairvoyant. The villagers thought she was a witch. Actually, it was a case of more than ordinary sensory powers, and Cravette was able to hypnotize her.
It was as though some mental compulsion was working on her. She began seeing things.
We planned a course of hypnosis to try and find out where these compulsions were coming from, but we never got started. There was a man. He went up the mountain. He was missing for 24 hours, and then he came down. His coordinations were not quite right. Just like Brett. First opportunity he got, he took a meat axe to the old woman. We got there about 10 minutes later. We're both dead.
How did the man die? The man had been dead already 24 hours.
Okay, what have we just watched? Give us a rundown.
Right, we've just watched The Trollenberg Terror, the film version. The original TV version is completely missing. Possibly was never recorded in the first place. And as with a number of TV science fiction things in the 1950s or so, film versions were made. So that happened with all of the Quatermass serials. That happened with The Creature Which Became the Abominable Snowman on ITV. It happened with Trollenberg Terror. It happened with The Strange World of Planet X. It happened with The Night of the Big Heat, Little Red Monkey, Miranda. There are a few where we can see what the original plot was because film versions were made, even though the original TV version is lost or partially lost.
Well, reading from the oracle that is Wikipedia, on the Swiss mountain Trollenberg, one of three student climbers is suddenly killed, his head ripped from his body. Two sisters, Anne and Sarah Pilgrim, a London mine reading act, are travelling by train to Geneva when Anne faints as the train passes the mountain. Upon waking, Anne insists that they must get off at the next stop. UN troubleshooter Alan Brooks, in the same train compartment as the sisters, goes to Trollenberg's observatory. Professor Cravette explains that despite many climbing accidents, no bodies are ever found, and an always stationary radioactive cloud is regularly observed on the mountain's south face. Brooks mentions similar incidents that took place in the Andes 3 years earlier, just before a similar radioactive cloud vanished without a trace. Local rumours circulated that something was living in the heavy mist. Anne is giving a mind-reading demonstration at the hotel when she sees two men in the base camp at the hut on the mountain. Dewhurst is asleep when the other man, Brett, under some kind of mental compulsion, walks outside as the cloud envelops the hut. Anne suddenly faints again, Brooks phones the hut, Dewhurst answers, but the connection goes dead. A rescue party, including Brooks, climbs up to the hut looking for the men. Anne, in a trance-like state, urges the rescuers to stay away. Inside the hut, the rescuers discover that everything is frozen solid, despite the door being locked from the inside. Dewhurst's body is found under a bed, its head missing. A spotter plane arrives and circles overhead, and a man is spotted half a mile away. The first rescuer finds a rucksack at that location with a severed head inside. He's set upon and killed by Brett, who also kills the second rescuer when he arrives. Later at the hotel, Brett suddenly staggers in, claiming that he'd been lost on the mountain. Soon after, he attacks Anne with a knife, but Brooks manages to subdue him. Brett sustains a severe head gash during the struggle, but no blood flows from the wound. He is heavily sedated and locked away. Brooks recalls to journalist Philip Truscott a similar incident in the Andes that followed a similar pattern. A man murdered an elderly woman who had alleged psychic abilities displayed just like those of Anne. The killer's body was discovered to have been dead for at least 24 hours prior to the murder of the old woman. Brett escapes his improvised cell and resumes his hunt for Anne, this time armed with a hand axe. But before he can reach her, Brett dispatches him with a pistol. Brett's flesh appears crystallized upon inspection and rapidly decomposes in the heat. The cloud has now begun to move down the mountainside towards the hotel, so the guests retreat to the fortified observatory. A mother realizes that her young daughter is missing as they enter the cable car. Yes, right. In a thickening mist, a giant tentacled creature with a single huge eye appears at the hotel, smashing down the front door. Brooks manages to rescue the child from the lobby, both of them narrowly escaping. They return to the cable car, but the delay gives the mist a chance to reach the car platform. The transport motor begins to freeze, starting and stopping, the cable slipping, but the cable car arrives safely. The single cloud is now split into five while converging on the observatory. Hans, who left the hotel by car, suddenly turns up at the observatory. Once inside, he begins exhibiting the same obsession with Anne. He tries to strangle her, but Brooks and Truscott stop him as Brooks stabs him. As the monsters near the observatory, everyone makes Molotov cocktails to combat them. By radio, Alan orders an aerial firebombing raid against the observatory, which has a reinforced concrete roof and walls that can withstand the assault. Truscott strikes one of the creatures with a Molotov cocktail, setting it ablaze. He is caught by a tentacle from another monster, now atop the observatory's roof. Brooks set that one ablaze with another Molotov cocktail, forcing it to drop Truscott. Later, he firebombs another creature that manages to breach a portion of thick wall to get her down. The aerial firebombing assault begins and successfully torches the remaining monsters. The end. Well, I think actually this... a very detailed précis, but it does make it sound a lot more exciting than it was for 90% of the film.
The start was slow.
Mm.
But there were quite a lot of characters. Mm. It did a good and effective job of introducing them, significantly more subtle than Anne did introducing herself to Forrest Tucker, because what she did was land face first in his lap.
On a train, yeah. Oh, I'm going to faint. I'm just fainting into your crotch.
You really are. Seeing as her sister is the one that disappears off with him at the end. Well, that's keeping it in the family. Yeah, so it's slow to start, but it builds up tension. And you can understand how that kind of thing would be a slow burn over 6 weeks, building up the tension with each episode, because this isn't an adaptation of a TV series. TV series. The characters were all well played. I don't think there was a single duff performance.
No.
Some of the exposition that you imagine will have happened in the TV series, so the whole crystalline skin and rapid decomposition and stuff, was done in about two words in a single special effects shot. But they were condensing 3 hours of television into an hour and 20 minutes film.
Yeah, stuff like the cable car. I imagine that was played out a lot longer on television. Mm.
And like I say, that was one of the things that my mum specifically remembered as being tense and exciting. And it's about 2 minutes in the film. And it's quite a nice effect of the creatures trying to freeze the gear mechanism for the cable car. And it's sort of stopping and starting and jolting along. But a couple of reaction shots and a couple of film sequences of the gearing mechanisms freezing and going white. And then suddenly they're at the observatory and there's not really any tension built up.
No.
The whole young child going missing, you would hope, was managed better on the telly, because it was very much I've had to look after my child for 10 minutes and she's fucked off and I haven't noticed. Presumably the nanny was off.
My kid has gone. I'm sure I had one.
Yeah, except with a German accent.
Exactly, yes.
And the whole notion of when you're evacuating somewhere, women and children first.
Abandoned.
Yeah, completely abandoned. And a big chunk of that, and okay, you can say women first, a little bit sexist. Children first is a really good idea because they're like herding cats. They are easily distracted, and particularly younger children. If there's stuff going on that adults need to concentrate on, you get the kids out of the way. So leaving some little brat until the last cable car doesn't make any sense, unless the little monster had fucked off beforehand. We're making quite a point about this, child, but... it is quite a big part of the film, and it's when you first get to see the monsters.
Which you weren't terribly impressed by. There was a definite oh dear moment when it popped on screen, because it's the first time we see the monster, which is basically a big squiggly blob with an eye in it and tentacles. I actually thought it was, for the time...
For the time, it's not bad.
I've always had a thing about eyes. I mean, if you get the eyes right on a monster, it pretty much excuses everything else. You can, if you focus on them... they weren't bad eye effects.
And in America, this was called the crawling eye.
The crawling eye. I've just seen on, again, on the Oracle, the nightmare terror of the slithering eye that unleashed agonizing horror on a screaming world.
And there were a lot of nicely done effects. The headless body in the hut, the head in it.
In the hold all. Yeah, that was nicely done.
All of that was nicely done.
Philip Truscott being hauled up onto the observatory roof by the tentacle at the end of the film.
Lawrence Payne.
Lawrence Payne, Dastari himself.
And Johnny Ringo.
Oh, yes, and Morrix. Yes, yeah. He was at least three times a Who alumnus.
I think that's the three. Mm. I think he was the only member of the original TV cast that translated into film.
And indeed was stunt-doubled by a terrible little toy.
Yeah, that wasn't great.
It was only for a brief second. It was a second's worth.
It's literally a second on screen.
Yeah, that was fairly bad. But we've got a good cast in this. There's Forrest Tucker in it. This is Alan Brooks, obviously the American lead to sell it overseas. But he was in The Abominable Snowman.
He was. And playing quite a different character, because he was the hunter in that one, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
And basically playing quite a shit.
Yeah.
Whereas in this one, he's kind of the romantic heroic lead. Although it's odd that they split that role between him and Lawrence Payne.
Mm.
I don't think you needed both of those.
And Lawrence Payne, really, the whole romance thing is tacked on in the last scene. There's no hint of romance from him all the way through. It's just at the very end of the film. Hello, you don't appear to have copped off with anyone yet. I'll take you for coffee, my dear. Who else have we got in this? Well, Janet Monroe is Anne Pilgrim. Now, she does a lot of wide-eyed, frightened acting in this. There's not actually an awful lot of dialogue for her.
But she does the wide-eyed acting very well.
She does the wide-eyed acting, largely because of her wide eyes. They're wider than the Trollenberg Terror. But they go on all the way through about how she's helping them until she's knocked unconscious. Neither of us could work out exactly how she was helping the war effort, because she did fuck all.
Well, she kind of got in the way by, I'm going to be here, I'm going to be here. No, I'm fucking off up the mountain.
And without telling anybody.
And when she gets the mountain, it's, no, my dear, I don't think you should go that way. Come this way. And it's, all right, yes, I will sit here and I'll be meek and then I'm going to fuck off. And
oh, look, somebody's coming to the research base and they're behaving exactly the same way as the last killer, but I won't tell anyone. I'll just go and hide in this office quietly.
Hello, Reuben.
From the horror of Fang Rock, Colin Douglas as Hans, the barman, who later on gets possessed by these aliens and tries to kill Anne. Who else have we got in this? Warren Mitchell as Professor Cravette. Now, apart from an archetypal sort of Einstein-esque performance when he's introduced as this mad German professor, I actually thought he was very good in this.
I thought he was excellent. Yeah, he put in an excellent performance. Okay, it was a bit Teutonic, but of its time.
Mm.
Okay, it becomes useful later, but quite why they have to make such a big thing about having cameras off on the roof when they've got a big window.
Yes.
And they were very good cameras.
They were excellent cameras. They'd give 2022 CCTV a run for its money. There's two mountain climbers about 200 miles away. I'll just zoom in on their faces.
And we can see what they got stuck in their teeth. But science fiction.
Let's gloss over these things. He was just a scientist who enjoyed his toys and I want this, I will get it. And he was very proud of the fact. Did I enjoy this thing? Yes, I did. Was nothing like... I honestly thought it was going to be another sort of Abominable Snowman thing. There was going to be a colony of Sasquatches living halfway up this mountain. That's what's bumping everybody off. There's a few leaps of logic. A lot of what goes on in the film has already happened in the past, but nobody's worked it out. A lot of the exposition relies on stuff that's already gone in the past for them to work it out.
There was a similar incident in the Andes 3 or 4 years previously, which a number of the characters had been involved with and were following up from. And the reason that Forrest Tucker's character turned up at the Trollenberg is because he'd recognised similarities to things that had happened while they were in the Andes. So I don't think that's that massive a deus ex machina, because it was a follow-on from a very similar previous incident.
Mm.
Now, you could argue that it's not actually that massive of a world invasion if it had happened 3 years previously and a mountain had been evacuated for a bit and that was about it.
Mm.
But it's not on.
It's these alien Johnnies and they just...
You squishy fellow.
But there was a bit of a leap of logic that... Well, there's a cloud on a mountain, and it might be hiding aliens, you know. And
it was a cloud that had been static for weeks and was radioactive.
Still a bit of a leap of logic to assume that it's an alien invasion.
And exactly the same thing with another cloud had happened in the Andes. And Warren Mitchell's character and Forrest Tucker's character and Lawrence Payne's character had all been involved in that Andean event. So no, I don't think that's that massive a leap of logic, because it's another iteration of the same thing that had happened there.
Oh, yeah, it was more the fact that they'd leapt straight to it must be aliens rather than any other unknown meteorological phenomenon.
Well, no, because it wasn't purely meteorological.
No, it was
as it goes on, you find out that in the Andes, there had been this whole thing about people had been able to be telepathic and pick up exactly what was going on and be precognitive. And then somebody who'd been missing and dead turned up and axe murdered some old lady. And then when they examined the body, had clearly been dead for 24 hours beforehand. All this weird shit that was never actually mentioned at the beginning. And when they're starting to talk about, oh, I put my career on the line mentioning strange stuff in the Andes, you would have thought things like a murderer who'd been dead for 24 hours would be given a little more front and center status rather than just casually mentioning in passing several days later. But all in all, I mean, it's a 1950s B-movie. You can pick it apart, and we're being fairly deep dive on this.
Yes, for a bit of 1950s fluff. And you and I both love our 50s B-movies.
We do. I really enjoyed that. Like I say, it's one that I'd watched with my mum, and she said that the original TV series was much better. But, you know, she was watching it in her 50s, 60s, and had originally seen it as a young teenager. So I'm sure there are things that I would remember watching at the age of 11 or 12 or something that if I were to watch them now may not stand the test of time.
I can think of several examples from my own childhood. Spoiler, they don't. Mm. Yes, they look dreadful through 44-year-old eyes.
But I really enjoyed that.
I don't think you can go far wrong with 50s B-movies in general, because you know that you're not going to get a 21st century CGI-laden blockbuster.
And, you know, I grew up on things like The Monolith Monsters and Them and This Island Earth and all the...
Oh, The Invaders, The Man Who Fell to Earth.
Man Who Fell to Earth was a little bit later.
It was a bit later. What am I thinking of? The Day the Earth Stood Still.
The Day the Earth Stood Still. Yeah, all of those were...
Thursday Nights, BBC Two. It was marvellous. So I used to watch all those. And my dad sat plonked us down in front of those while he went off and did the housework. So, right, just sit down and watch those. And, of course, we loved them. And these went on for weeks, all these old B-movies. And some of them, we've had a bloody hot summer this year, just for once. And I thought that it's about time The Day the Earth Caught Fire was dug out. Another 1960s B-movie, but brilliant stuff. It's made with Tuppence Halfpenny, and it's just great.
And a miserable ending.
Yes, terrible because ending.
At the end of the day, everybody's going to die. Okay, they go and hide in a submarine for a bit while the seas boil, but...
So, yes, the Trollenberg Terror, you're not going to. Just watch it ironically.
Yeah, and it's being done as a tribute to my mum, who died Halloween last year. And liked her gin. And anybody else's that wasn't nailed down, frankly.
Splishy splashy. But what have you got to roll us out with this time? Because we've got a little bonus, haven't we?
We do. Unless we have a bonus.
It's like a bonus drinky as well.
We could do with a bonus TS.
Oh, I'll have a rummage around in the cupboard and find us a Halloween gin.
Yeah, you're pretending you don't know exactly what we're about to go and pour out.
Don't spoil it for boys and girls, lad. There's a bag of chips in it for you. Tonight we are drinking Hall & Bramley Spiced Pumpkin Gin. It's a small batch, a rich and warming spiced pumpkin gin by Hall & Bramley Limited. 37.5%, and the info bollock says, here at Hall & Bramley, we love to do things differently. In fact, we've been doing it this way since 1860, and this spiced pumpkin gin is no exception. We've taken copper pot distilled gin and expertly blended it with natural flavours to create a gin that tastes exceptional. Well, it's very pumpkin-coloured in the bottle. Dr. Axon, nasal appraisal?
Well, visual appraisal first.
Oh, dear, here we go.
It looks like iron brew.
Oh, it do. I thought you were going to say something about an alcoholic's piss or something.
No, it doesn't really look specimen-y. It looks like iron brew.
Right. Sorry, the medical side of you just come out. It does actually look like iron brew in the glass when it's mixed with tonic and ice. So, Ooh, nasal-wise.
It is quite spicy.
It's smart, and a little bit bunky. That's very inviting. Well, eyes down, dive in.
It's not pumpkin-y.
No.
It's spicy, particularly cinnamony.
That's not bad. Now, it's not what I was expecting. It's not a million miles off what I was expecting. Pumpkin itself, it's not a massively flavourful thing.
Oh, it can be.
It can be, but it rarely is.
Pumpkin curry. I absolutely love pumpkin curry.
I'm pleasantly surprised by that because I was expecting something a little bit sickly sweet, and it isn't. There's a definite sweetness to it. It doesn't actually say what's in it, but there's got to be cinnamon in there, healthy dosings of it.
It's nice. I don't think it's particularly special. I was hoping for something more pumpkin flavoured because I love the flavour of pumpkin, and particularly as a savoury thing.
Mm. In itself, it's not something I would dive for, but if you want something for Halloween that's a little bit of a novelty.
It's nicer, and it's much nicer than the last pumpkin thing that we had.
Yeah.
That pumpkin liqueur.
Yes, pumpkin spice, I think that was.
Yep. It's a 4 from me. It's interesting enough to raise it above a 3, but it's not pumpkin-y enough for me to give it a 5.
I'd agree with that. It's a 4 from me as well, and it does do what it says on the tin, a rich and warming spiced pumpkin gin. It certainly warms you on the way down.
Yeah, and rich, yes, spiced, yes, pumpkin, not really.
Yes, so enjoy your Halloween, boys and girls. This is not a bad drink to have with it.
Woohoo! So we are finishing off our Halloween evening with a little treat from Kaleidoscope.
Okay, what have you got for me this time?
Well, one of the first programmes shown in this country in colour, if not the first, was the BBC horror anthology series Late Night Horror.
Oh, my God. Right, okay.
Yeah, the
title sequence.
Title sequence is Nightmare Fuel. They only made 6 episodes. There was plans to make more, but there were so many viewer complaints about how horrific it was. Paddy Russell directed the first episode, which doesn't exist, but it was an episode on vampirism, and she was told just to make it as bloody as possible. A black and white telly recording was recovered by Kaleidoscope a number of years ago, and they've been able to use the chroma dot.
Oh, so this is in colour.
I haven't watched it, but I have had a little sneaky preview, and the colour looks amazing.
Really? Because chroma dot recovery can be really hit and miss.
This one works well.
Excellent.
I mean, it won't just be a pure algorithm recovery. Kaleidoscope and their team will have done an absolute fuck ton of work on this, and we can talk about that afterwards. But my brief snippet of seeing it, you can tell they've worked on it.
Well, I haven't seen a frame of this. So without further ado, it's Ron VT, Late Night Horror, which, what's this one called?
The Corpse Can't Play.
You've gone quiet again.
I tried to think up a game.
The only game I can recall from my prehistoric childhood is one where we all gathered round a rather squat little boy who spat into the living room fire.
Well, thank God for central heating.
I suppose there must have been some point to it.
You know, kids can be little devils at times. When I was in there just now, I got the distinct impression that one of them, what's his name, Potter?
Simon Potter.
Yes. The others were having a go at him. I didn't think he'd been invited.
No, he wasn't.
Ah, well, that explains it. He was probably being punished for gate crashing.
No, boys, you're not to go outside. It's far too wet. Now stay indoors, please.
You heard?
No, Mr. Jarman.
And what game's this?
Murder.
Right.
So, that was Late Night Horror, The Corpse Can't Play. We have some alumni. While you compose yourself.
Yes.
Right. Neil Hallett was Malin Rennis in Time Lash. He was the father.
Yeah. It's been a long time since I've watched Lame Shit.
And also played the regular character of Tony Miller in Ghost Squad and GS5. Christine Pollan was the voice of the Oracle in Underworld. Samuel Burley was also the child priest in The Underwater Menace, and those are his only 2 credits. Erin Geraghty is still working. This was her first TV credit, and among other things, she played the regular character in the early years of Angels. Kim Goody, again, still working, and best known as one of the regulars on Number 73, the Saturday morning programme with Sandy Toksvig.
Sandy Toksvig.
There we go. So, the plot was fairly horrible. It's all about all around a children's party, and the young lad having the birthday is a tempted to call him a selfish brat, but he isn't particularly. He's a
standard.
He's an early teenage lad who's a bit of a selfish git. And he's invited a lot of his mates, and they're having a perfectly standard kids' game party thing. And they play, it's not musical statues, musical chairs, and all the normal kids' games thing that we used to do way back in the day. And kids today will probably have no clue what you're talking about. And that's counterpointed by the mother and her friend in the kitchen just getting everything ready and chatting and saying, oh, it wasn't like it was in our day, blah, 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 blah. All very domesticated, but really quite loud from the kiddie's point of view, which is kind of what you expect. And then there's a knock on the door, and this other lad who hadn't been invited turns up, a lad called Simon, who's brought a very expensive gift. Isn't terribly popular. Ronnie, the lad whose birthday it is a bit of an arse to him right from the word go, saying, I didn't invite you, I didn't want you here.
Mm.
And you're tempted to think, well, you know, under those circumstances, I'd say, fuck you, I don't really want to be here either, I'm off. But this lad, Simon, doesn't, and he stays around, and he's massively excluded. And you learn through the sort of expositional kitchen stuff that his father had died a few years before, and his mother is presumably working. They say that he has to stay late at school because there isn't anybody at home. And you just wonder whether sending a particularly expensive gift is a kind of compensation thing. Anyway, he goes in. Simon is obviously awkward. It sort of hangs about at the door, but doesn't want to go in, isn't well received when he goes in. Ronnie makes up this game where everybody has to act out what their father does. Won't let Simon get away with saying, I don't want to do this. And then when he won't do anything, Ronnie just says, oh, well, it's very easy for you to do what your father does, and lays down with his arms across his chest in a sort of funeral pose, which is a bit of a shitty thing to do. And then they're going to play a game of murder, and the kids have to hide around the house. And Ronnie goes to Simon and says, look, I'm really sorry about earlier. I didn't mean it. I'd like us to be friends. Why don't we go and hide together? And then locks him in a cupboard upstairs. And he's shouting and knocking on the door and wanting to get let out of this locked cupboard. Father of the household comes back and has a whole lot of garden tools with him that have just been sharpened, which is a massive Chekhov thing.
So how could these possibly be part of the plot later on?
Yes, Chekhov's garden implements. And and also, Ronnie has prepared a tray of sort of gruesome things, like a glove full of jelly and a peeled grape, and again, all the
standard
Halloween-y things. The father goes upstairs to put the tools out of harm's way. Hears knocking from this cupboard that Simon's been locked into, and the next thing you see is this kids' game. Ronnie coming through to the kitchen, getting all his bits and pieces for his murder game, going back in. All the kiddies are around in a circle, and he puts the lights out and does the "this is the corpse's hair" and puts it in somebody's hand, and they scream. And this is the corpse's hand, puts it in somebody's hand. And this is the corpse's eye. And just before he does that, the door opens up again, and somebody comes in. And when the lights go up, you see that the corpse's hair and the corpse's hand and the corpse's eye are actually real bloodstained hair, hand, and eye. So all the kids that are holding these go absolutely berserk and screaming all over the place. Two women come out of the kitchen. The friend is trying to control all of these absolutely hysterical kids. And the wife goes upstairs and finds her husband's corpse dismembered on the landing floor with an eye missing and blood all over the place. And Simon comes up and says, oh, well, you know what, Mrs., it's only fair. Now I'm not the only kid who doesn't have a father. That was fairly horrible.
It was fucking awful. I
really enjoyed that.
I mean, you knew that something bad was going to happen. I didn't quite know what it was. It was fairly obvious when Daddy comes home with a load of gardening equipment, including a hatchet, then something quite unpleasant is going to happen.
I'd assumed the little brat Ronnie was going to be the one that would get offed, but rather than the father.
Yeah. And it's only the very last scene where the horror kicks in.
Oh, scene before where they're all in the...
The actual body parts in the game, yes. But that final scene with the little ginger kid in glasses stood next to the mother.
This is only fair.
I'm not the only one without a dad now. And the final shot
The final shot is zooming in on that kid's face.
On that kid's face, looking smug as fuck. And
looking blank. He wasn't looking particularly smug. He was just looking completely blank.
But the shot of the father on the landing, missing an eye, it was a close-up shot with very, very good... That was fucking awful.
Yeah. On the other hand, it was 11 o'clock at night. It was called Late Night Horror. We saw the trailer before that had preceded it with Valentine Dial saying, if you don't like creepy shit, don't watch this.
Do you feel frightened of the dark? Squeamish about blood? If you do, I would strongly advise you, as a friend, to avoid this channel late on Fridays for the next few weeks. You see, they're starting a series, a most unpleasant series. Perhaps you're laughing. Perhaps you think you are above being frightened by a television program. In that case, why not switch on BBC Two at 10:55 tonight? Turn out the lights and watch Late Night Horror. But please, don't watch it alone. You never know what might be looking over your shoulder.
Valentine Dial, I love his voice. That's the voice of somebody who smoked 80 a day for 50 years.
It sounds good.
It sounds good. There's only two men that I've ever wished I had their voice. There's John Hurt and Valentine Dial. Possibly Richard Burton sneaks in there as well.
Fran.
I've been reading a lot recently, Fran. Devouring books. Swallowing them whole. I'm ravenous. That's something you shouldn't like. Is that crowbarred? Does that sneak under the doormat?
Problem is, it's still really funny. That's the big... If it was shit, I would have no problem.
For those of you that don't know, that is a Black Books reference. It's an episode with Peter Serafinovich. I really enjoyed that. I mean, Late Night Horror is one of those things. I cannot let this go without reference to. I alluded to it earlier, but the title sequence is creepy as fuck. Look it up on YouTube, kids. In itself, it's nothing. It's an oscillating head and a fly on somebody's hand and a skull. Yeah, describing it like that, yeah, what's your problem, mate? Watch it.
Yeah. Well, it goes from the oscillating head and the hand to the hand ripping off the entire face and scalp to leave the skull.
It's that oscillating head that does my... that is really creepy.
It's a bit doll-like, isn't it?
It's horrible. And seeing it in colour... On the beautifully restored DVD, which is... it's Kaleidoscope they're behind this, aren't they? But there is the unrestored black and white version, and the difference is absolutely chasmic. The title sequence will be creepy, whether it's in black and white or not, but in colour, hats off, guys. You have done a really cracking job with this. What a lovely little restoration. And considering it's on DVD, one half-hour episode, there's a load of extras on there.
And at the time, people wouldn't have seen colour TV before. So something like this may have been somebody's first exposure to colour TV.
The very first thing in colour was actually Wimbledon. That's how BBC officially launched colour TV. But again, early 70s, how many people actually had? Was this early 70s or late 60s?
This was 68. I think this was one of the first, if not the first,
drama series
that the BBC put out in colour.
But if that is an example of what the rest of the series is like...
I really wish the rest existed, because that was fantastic.
That must have been nightmare fuel at the time. I'm not surprised it didn't go to a second series. Mary Whitehouse must have been...
Well, it was stopped partway through the first series. They had other episodes that were planned, and production was stopped because there were so many viewer complaints.
Hats off all round. That was wonderful stuff. Because for a lot of it, it is kitchen sink drama. And it's only the fact that you know something truly grim is going to happen later on that keeps you watching. Now, I can't praise that highly enough. What a great piece of TV.
And a beautiful, beautiful recovery from Kaleidoscope. So as well as praising the show, we really need to praise them.
Absolutely. Completely, absolutely. Kaleidoscope do a lot of work behind the scenes on missing stuff recovery. And it's because a lot of the stuff that they recover is, it will be viewed by the wider public as low-grade stuff, so TVAM, that sort of thing, or episodes of The Big Breakfast or stuff like that. Yes, it might not have any commercial release value, but in terms of archive TV value, yeah, wonderful. Stuff that they're turning up off, you know, Sky recordings and, you know, very early BSB recordings, they might mean nothing to the vast, vast majority of the population, but they're missing, they're filling gaps, they're doing it every day. People are turning up hordes of VHS, audio cassettes, really obsolete video formats from the 60s and 70s that people have never even heard of. We're recovering stuff all the time. Kaleidoscope do a fantastic job.
Yes, hats off to you guys.
And with that, we shall raise a glass to all of you archive aficionados and hunters out there. Wish you a happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween and hello to our niche.
The Exton Moss Experiment featured Simon Exton and Ken Moss. All featured soundtracks are the property of their respective producers, and no infringement of copyright is intended. Title music was performed by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, and the programme was produced by Maverick Productions. For more information, please visit maverickproductionsuk.blogspot.com or find us on social media.